Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Julius Bailey, author of Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond, an honest look at the current state of our society and a definitely wake-up call for America. But before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Julius. Julius Bailey is a Christian existentialist who teaches in the Department of Philosophy at Wittenberg University. He is a philosopher, cultural critic, social theorist, and diversity lecturer. As a socially conscious academic, Dr. Bailey has been interviewed on CNN, Fox, BET, and ABC Nightline. A guest on numerous radio shows as a social critic and education advisor, he is often sought to speak at colleges, prisons, and community organizations across America. For more information on Julius and his book, visit his website at www.juliusbailey.com, and that is JuliusBailey.com. Hi, Julius. How are you doing today?
Good afternoon. Thank you, Susan, for the interview.
Oh, thank you for being here. Our reviewer loved your book. And Paige had a lot of things to say about it, too. She was very interested on the topic in the beginning, and in the end, she was really happy she read the book because it had clarified so many things for her, from politics to racial issues to her own issues, if you may. Mm-hmm. Why don't we start by telling our listeners a little bit about your background and upbringing?
Sure. Well, I am from the south side of Chicago. I grew up primarily in parochial Catholic schools. I was a grandson of a Baptist minister. And so, you know, between being very active in my local parish and going to my granddaddy's church on the evenings and during the week, I guess you can say I was sort of very inculcated by at least these two forms of Christianity, namely the Baptist Church and the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. I think growing up with that type of sort of spiritual background really assisted me to at least come to understand what it means to be a moral being. Then when you couple with sort of my influences growing up in terms of the pastors and priests who influenced my life were very politically and socially active ministers. And so I grew up watching how the pulpit and politics intertwined, how individuals who considered themselves leaders within the church also had to ensure that not just the Bible or whatever they were preaching with from the pulpit spoke to their spiritual being, but also the Bible and their instruction had to speak to their sort of daily social realities. And so I think, you know, with that background, then I left my high school, then I went to college in Washington, D.C. at Howard University, one of the nation's sort of most preeminent black colleges in America. There I learned a little bit more about what activism is, what justice looks like, being at the home, you know, Thurgood Marshall, for instance, right, mm-hmm. our first black Supreme Court justice, and other individuals who fundamentally helped me to understand what it means to be, you know, an agent in the world who concerns myself with the doings and sufferings of folk around me. And so I took that Howard experience. I then went to Harvard for graduate school. That's where I went to start to work with Cornel West. I was able to do some teaching with him, under him as a teaching fellow. Mm-hmm. And then I left after an African American Studies degree, and then when I went to get my PhD from the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. You have such an interesting background because you were lucky to be influenced with the topics that now interest you. Mine was totally the opposite. We were an Italian immigrant family in South America. And my family mixed well with the culture and races and everything. So I have cousins that we look totally different.
Sure.
So I never had issues. I never lived or heard about racial issues until I came to the U.S.
Sure.
And it was really surprising to me. And also it was a small Catholic community. And so a missionary Italian Catholic community. And so everything was different. And then when I left is when all the cold showers started to fall that woke me up with many things. And I am passionate about philosophy. I took in college my major in political sciences and took classes on theology and philosophy.
Sure.
So you can bet I'm going to read your book. I just haven't had a chance yet. But I kind of experiment with my reviewers, and then if they like it, I'll read.
Right, I understand that.
But what really, really caught my attention when I read your bio is that you call yourself a Christian existentialist.
Yes.
Okay, and I know Christianity and existentialism are kind of opposites in many ways. So can you tell our listeners, what is Christian existentialism?
Right. Well, I mean, they certainly can diverge. So, I mean, you aren't incorrect there. I think I get my sort of understanding of that term or that genre of identity through a philosopher, Soren Kierkegaard. And Soren Kierkegaard was a 19th century a philosopher who considered himself an existentialist, but also a devout Christian. And so for him, and then for me later on, now obviously living in the 21st century, I think it revolves around understanding a couple different things. One is that our existence precedes our essence. Right, and so that is countervailing to a lot of spiritual ideas, right? Because you hear stories of Jeremiah that he'd say things like, "Before you were born, I knew you," right? And so then we learn, live in your purpose, live in your calling, those type of languages, right? And so we get used to that, and God ordained your life and things like that, right? And so you think, well, I have something that already was supposed to be my journey, was always supposed to be my fate, if you will. And the existentialists don't believe that. The existentialist maintains that our life and our journey is constantly evolving, and that our destinies, if you will, are self-made and self-created. And it's not that we're necessarily opposed, at least I am as a Christian existentialist, I'm not opposed to a doctrine of God in this sense, but I am sort of, I don't believe that my essence was ordained before I lived. I think that if that's the case, I have 1,000 questions for God, right? I mean, if it is the case, I mean, why couldn't I have been born Italian, right? I mean, why is it that God has put me within a context like this, born in 72, within in America? Luckily, I was born in 72 and not 42. You know what I'm saying? But, I mean, still, what is it like to say, well, you were born black in America, and that identity holds not only historic problems for the American consciousness, but that problem will not end, right? So I have to sort of keep reminding myself that I can't think God ordained me to this thing. I have to think that I have to live my life in such a way that I construct and reconstruct, I make and remake who I am as a being in the world. That's the first thing. The second thing, when it comes to church, that's like one of the things that existentialists have problems with that obviously the church doesn't, is that the idea of dogma. Right? And so what is it that dogma does for the psyche and spirit that doesn't allow for the freedom, right? So one of the pure sort of tenets of existentialism is freedom, right? One's ability to choose one's own fate, to decide one's own actions, to have autonomy in a world that is potentially absurd. That is to say, that even in spite of whatever it is I claim that I want to do or I can do, I'm always up against either other people or I'm always up against other structures that hinder that particular agency, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's always this sort of push and pull with my visions, my ideas, my hopes, my dreams up against the way in which other people have their ideas and hopes and dreams, right? And so, you know, the Christian existentialist realizes that we understand that there is a God. We feel that there is a power that was a creator, for instance. We're not scientific in the sense that we believe that there is purely a Big Bang reality. I mean, that is not antithetical to us, but we certainly believe that there could very likely be an original creator, a first cause, if you will.
It's what they call intelligent creation.
An intelligent creator, exactly, right? And so I think, you know, I maintain that. But when I go to church, for instance, and I joke with students all the time, you know, I go to church, you know, because I recognize that there's a culture associated with it. There's a religion, right? The etymology is that religare, and ligare means to bind, right? And that binding of individuals, that binding of like spirits, that binding of like ideas. And I appreciate that, right? I mean, I don't want to be alone, right? One of the things that the existentialists always fight up against is a sense of isolation, a sense of loneliness in a world, even though everybody's there, right? Not, you know, trying to come to grips with who I am and what is the purpose of my existence as I keep creating it up against the world that sometimes it doesn't allow me to be that, right? So I think that's where it diverges. I personally think that, you know, when I hear stories of the Bible, for instance, or of the Quran or of the Torah, right, what I think of is not just truth qua truth, right? That is to say, I don't think everything is, you know, the rational Julius is saying, well, you know, am I actually going to live or die on the ultimate truth of these stories, or am I going to realize that there is truth within the story? Right. And so as we understand these stories and these allegories and these, you know, the findings and these, you know, the movements of Jesus, for instance, or even Muhammad, or, you know, we say, well, there could be truth in that, and moral stories and prescriptions toward individuals and how we treat one another are important. And so for me, as I've lived my life during these years, it's important that I had that background. It's important that I grew up both Catholic and on the weekends with my granddaddy, Baptist, right? It's important to have wine at the church and grape juice, right? Because at a certain level, you're able to see and understand just how different people can see the same God differently, right? And so it's not a competition of whose God is better. It's an understanding that we're living a cultural reality, not necessarily an epistemic reality.
Mm-hmm. Very, very well explained. And I think that a lot of people in the end evolve a little bit if they get out of their nest and, you know, or they actually have an awakening in some sort in different aspects of their own beliefs because of a traumatic experience.
Mm.
And I grew up within the second one because my parents were survivors of World War II, so there was a lot of post-traumatic stress in my family. Did you evolve in this point of view, this vision that you have on how you process beliefs and culture, or was there like an aha moment for you somewhere?
I think it probably was an evolution, right? And an aha moment, right? So when I think of the ways in which, I mean, the ultimate question for me is everybody can't be right, right? And if everybody is right, then everybody's right about an aspect of the truth, right? So you can't, for instance, as my granddad used to say, you know, if the Bible is right, then everything else is wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, but, you know, remember, our belief in the Bible is a belief, right? So even if we follow the logic of that, if the Bible was right, the if part still is sort of unclaimed, right? and so, you know, yes, as Christians, we believe that the Bible is, as we learned in Bible study, the basic instruction before leaving Earth, right? We understand that, right? But we also realize that these are stories of people who, in many cases, weren't even there at the time, but heard stories of stories, and these are stories of other stories about individuals who may or may not have actually lived on this earth, right? Mm-hmm. And so you think about it, and you say, well, wait a minute. So if they're right, or if the Buddhists are right, if there is reincarnation and not necessarily, you know, this idea of heaven or hell, then one of us has to be wrong, right? And so it just began to realize, wait a minute, hold on. Let's understand this culturally and not as ultimate truth. Let's understand this, that even if there is one God, and this one God had a son named Jesus, and Jesus suffered and died and was buried, even if that was ultimately the case, Jesus has to have some understanding for those in other parts of the world throughout history that existed before Jesus and existed in context in which Jesus is not a part of their cultural milieu, right?
Yeah.
And so it just began to make me think that maybe I need to not be as oppressive in my understanding of Jesus. If I truly follow Jesus, follow his 11th commandment, which was to love everyone, right? And if it's about love, then it's about expanding who we are as humans, realizing that as long as whatever it is that, however it is that you serve, whatever God you serve, that you're in the business of spreading love, I'm good, right?
Yeah.
And so that's how I came to understand it. And so that's why, for instance, even this book, right? So it is fueled, you know, obviously by a Christian writer, but it takes a lot of time. For instance, in chapter 4, it talks about the reality of xenophobia, right? I mean, what is it do we actually look at when we're concerned about other people, how other people lived in other communities, in other worlds, with other religions, right? And so we have, so somehow as Christians we have to hate Muslims? Like, that makes no sense, right? And so I think for me it becomes both an aha moment intellectually, but I evolved into it just as a human in the world.
Awesome answer. I think it was in freshman year of high school. I asked our priest that was teaching us theology, and I asked him, you know, well, why are there so many religions if God wanted us to believe only one?
Mm.
And he told me, his answer was, well, God manifests in so many different ways. Mm. How can only be one theory that explains him?
Mm.
And that, you know, that answered it for me. Okay, I get it.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
get it and
you
don't
think
get
about
it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I get it and don't get it, right? I mean, that's not a good answer, Father, but...
Yeah, no, but it kind of answered me, because it's basically what you said. You know, what about the people that came before...
Right. Right.
You know, the time of Jesus Christ,
right.
Or what about the people that are living in the Amazon and they don't know about anything but their surroundings?
Sure.
And what, you know, and it is true. I mean, of course, people are going to explain their surroundings in, you know, in their own points of views,
right,
with their culture and their own experiences, and maybe evolve into something else or maybe not.
Right, right.
And, so,
and one of the things, obviously, Susan, one of the things that we as existentialists do diverge away from others is that, you know, we are at least I am, as a Christian, I am concerned about, or at least still in query about, the idea of heaven and hell.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so for us, right, life is what life is as we live, right? Anything outside of that is an irrational activity. Right? And so as a philosopher, I just want to engage in whatever it is that I can claim to know, right? Anything that I can't claim to know, to me, is pure faith. I'm okay with faith, obviously. I take these, as Kierkegaard would say, these leaps of faith. I have no problem with these leaps of faith. But at the same time, I don't have to leap all the way to heaven or leap all the way to hell either, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it could be simply the case, as Shakespeare says, I mean, only thing we are basically the operator of the flesh, the worm's affections, right? Mm-hmm. And upon death, that's who we are. The worms just take over who we are, right? And so we hate to think that, right? I mean, the hardest thing about what it means to live is to think about legacy, to think about where we might go and what we might do. We don't want to have conversations thinking that it might be literally over on that death date, right? And everything else about our body, everything else about our reality becomes literally what the Bible says, ashes to ashes and dust to dust,
yeah.
Right? And so it becomes... And then in the classroom is an interesting dynamic, because if you follow the logic, right, if the pastor tells you at funeral and at confirmation, for instance, that we all are from ashes and we all will end at ashes, if that's the case, then, you know, how do we have, where does this soul thing come from, right? Where does it come from? Where does it go? How does it leave? When does it leave?
Yeah.
Right? All these rational questions that we have, which outside the fact that we're hoping for something next, really makes no sense.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specialized in interviewing published authors about their current books and their areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download from your computer for your convenience. Please visit us at InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Julius Bailey, author of Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, The Age of Obama and Beyond. Stay tuned, because we are going to continue this interesting, enlightening, and inspiring conversation with Julius about Christian existentialism, hip-hop versus philosophy, American politics and racial issues, and so much more. But in the meantime, you can check out Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams by visiting Julius' website at www.juliusbailey.com, and that is JULIUSBAILEY.com.
I think about, you know, for instance, the death of Prince recently, right? And so you think that, wow, you know, look at the life he lived. And you hear people saying, well, you know, Prince is going to be in heaven playing with Michael Jackson and everybody else, right? And you think, well, that's a beautiful thought, right?
Or, yeah, that would be an awesome concert.
That's a nice thought, right? Or yeah. Prince is just dead, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's it, right? And so the more rational thought is it's over. Right? Anything else is just hope. And I think one of the things that as Christians we are, we're locked into hope, which is partly why this project is what it is. You know, the Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, it is a project of hope. It is understanding that irrespective of whatever sort of empirical data that I have on race relations, on international relations, on America as an imperialist nation, irrespective of the empirical evidence to the contrary, I still believe that America can be better because its people can be better. And when its people can be better and we operate, you know, with each other as ends in themselves, as you say, and not just means toward an end, I think that we, America, can be a better place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, when I grew up in I'm a cultural mess. I went to school in Venezuela in an American school, first grade, second, and third, and that's why I learned how to speak English from a young age. And, you know, even though there weren't very deep lessons in, you know, at that stage in my education, I could see the difference in cultures wherever I went. I mean, I went to a German school, I went to an Italian school, I went to a Venezuelan school, and that was my parents' vision, because they were so locked up in their world when Mussolini was there, that when the Allies came, there were all different cultures within their army, they stopped fighting. They didn't know where they were. They, you know, the people that didn't have any contact with the other, with the outside world, were baffled and lost because they realized they didn't know anything about the world, and so, and how it functioned. And so my mom had that vision, and she wanted us to learn culture different from ours.
Sure.
So that we didn't go through what she went through. And so when I came here, you know, even though I was familiar with everything, it was still a cultural shock. But the most cultural shock that I had was when my first daughter went to college. She went to Colorado College, which is a liberal art school. And she told me she signed up for hip-hop class. Because in my mind, hip-hop is music.
Right.
You know, I didn't see it as a way of life, philosophy, culture.
Sure.
I didn't see it. That was, you know, it was music. That's, you know, we would hear some hip-hop down there and you know, other than salsa and,
right,
and stuff. And, you know, it didn't occur to me. And she explained it to me. And so I would like to touch that hip-hop versus philosophy. How do they relate topic? And why should we attend your hip-hop course?
Wow.
Yeah, because it was such a – I am blown away by it. Even recently with Beyonce's new video, Lemonade? Yeah. Well, I was
– Limonada.
Limonada. I loved it because I saw so much historical African-American history, relevance, and even theology. There were, you know, from philosophy. I could relate to a bunch of stuff that she had in her video. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand it if it wasn't through the eyes of my daughter.
Dear,
I would have never.
Sure.
So I think it's it would be enlightening to listen to you talk about how they relate. How can what we many thought was a music trend is really a lot more.
Right. Well, wow. I mean, I didn't expect that one, but that's cool, right? So, I mean, clearly three of my book projects have had to do with hip-hop, right?
Mm-hmm.
The cultural impact of Kanye West, my philosophy of hip-hop book, and Jay-Z, hip-hop's philosopher.
And before you continue, I want to tell our listeners to please visit your website to check them out, along with Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams, which is an awesome book. To your website is www.juliusbailey.com, and that is JULIUSBAILEY.com.
Yes, yes. Thank you very much. So I think, you know, my understanding of hip hop is that we have to see hip hop as a sort of an organic development from a very specific set of social and political and racial realities that primarily was taken form in New York, but it wasn't exclusive to New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about, you know, what was going on at the time, and you couple in various other recent historical realities at the time. So if we, you know, historically we see hip-hop at around in 1976, right, the origin of hip-hop. And so at this time, obviously, you have now the children of the civil rights folk who are now sort of benefiting from non-segregation and things like that. But in cities like New York and others, you start to see the more and more the mass exodus of resources from the inner city to the suburbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in this sort of exodus of resources, you begin to see a sort of a relinquishing of social. Of the safety net, if you
mm-hmm.
will. And so what hip-hop speaks to is, one, an America in general, but, again, thinking about its origins, an urban America who sees itself as a blight on the sort of the radar of America's consciousness, who everybody wants to run away from and not run toward. And so the language, the music, the dance has all to do with combat, right, with battling,
mm-hmm.
with voice, with identity, right, with connection, right? And so these type of this these ethos, if you will, these ethos, is all the plural, but I mean, the way in which the ethos comes together is through responding against social, political, and racial angst, and still trying to, as the great Grandmaster Fly says, trying to stay from going under, right? Mm-hmm. He said, it's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under, right? How do I keep from allowing these social, political, and racial realities that are adversely affecting communities, especially urban communities, whether it's drugs, whether it's violence, whether it's the occupation of police forces, whether it's the lack of jobs or the movement of jobs, the growth and the development of housing communities known as quote-unquote projects, mm-hmm. And stacking people on top of each other, not spreading them out, right? How does this fit within the psyche of people? And so I think hip-hop speaks to that in its origins, right? As it's developed over the years, right, now it has to respond to an America who likes to look inside. I think it was the rapper Common who says, I'm going to open up my mental window so that you can come in. And if, white America, you are afraid to come in, then you can just peek in, right? So if you don't want to step into the hood, if you will, you are curious about the doings and sufferings and activities of Black America, because if you weren't, then you wouldn't have been, as you have been over history, capitalized over the culture of Black people, right? And so there's always been an interest in Black bodies, whether we're talking about Black bodies through, you know, the imperial times, trying to use them as fodder to build your nation, or whether we're talking about the use of Black bodies for entertainment, both from slavery, post-slavery, into this conversation now, or in this sense, you know, how do I understand, or how do I seek to understand what it is that these Black and brown bodies chiefly are saying in these urban areas about their condition? So when you then look at what philosophy is, right, at least what, you know, and all the various sort of branches of philosophy, from ethics to religion to epistemology, the study of knowledge, to metaphysics, and all these areas, you're trying to say, well, look, all these individuals live a reality that try to find some epistemic force. How do I come to know whatever it is that I come to know? There are certain moralities that are consistent within hip-hop culture that we need to speak about. And it's not just the Wu-Tang morality, cash rules everything around me, right? And so, because again, that's an American sort of a capitalistic ethos, not just American, but a capitalistic ethos that cash rules everything around me, right? So it's not, that's just not hip-hop specific, right? So I think what we do in philosophy and hip-hop is to understand how do we develop truth? How do we understand morality? How do we come to deal with our phenomenology, the way we see the world, the way we experience the world, up against how then we operate within our experience of the world? Obviously, there is a hip-hop aesthetic, right? As you say, the dance, the music, the mm-hmm. DJing, you know, those are the aesthetic forms of hip-hop that has sort of value that even you, in your South American context, can understand with salsa and merengue, and so those type of sort of African-centered dances that is rooted within a colonial experience, mm-hmm. that still finds itself to be as authentic as it can be, even amongst a colonial reality. And so all this stuff plays into, you know, I mean, you can't look at a hip-hop battle and not see a capoeira or some sense of sort of a South American, you know, a Brazilian dance.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, you see it, right? A capoeira, excuse me, I say capoeira. You know, and you see it. And so it's not far-fetched then for us professors to come in and say, well, I mean, we understand the African slave trade, over half of slaves stopped in Brazil, right? And so,
yeah.
I mean, you have to look at the ways in which Afro-Brazilian culture and even there in Venezuela and Peru and those areas that are heavily congregated by African people then moves itself up through, you know, through, you know, the Spanish rule, as they found themselves in the Canary Islands and all over the, you know, what we call the sort of the Caribbean, right? And then obviously, you know, moving its way up to North America. So all these are cultural remnants, right? They didn't even come out of the sky, right? These are cultural remnants aesthetically that we have to deal with. And then I think lastly, we talk about, you know, the issues of metaphysics. How do we come to know God? How do we come to know the soul? How do we come to experience ourselves as something that is not just material but spiritual? I think hip hop speaks to that as a reality of spirit, right? The great KRS-One, who called it sort of the teacher, the philosopher of hip hop, talks about hip hop as a metaphysic, right? I mean, I have some challenges with that, but I understand what he's saying. He's saying that when you adopt hip hop as a way of being, right, it becomes what the metaphysics, you know, the metaphysicians call first principle reality. And so you breathe hip hop. You sort of ingest and digest hip hop the same way we breathe and ingest and digest air, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is why it's bigger than just dance. And so they always ask in classes, well, can white people be do hip hop? Can Asians do hip hop? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, to do hip hop is one thing. To be hip hop is another, right? And so we can do. I mean, we experience all aspects of sort of imitative culture, right? But it's not to say it's inauthentic. It's just to say that, hey, well, I mean, we see things that we like, and we do those things, and it becomes real to them. But we cannot take away the nascent reality, the sort of the born reality of what it means to live within a social, political, and racial context that hip-hop comes from.
Yeah. It's amazing how much we could talk about this and you know, it's so interesting as well. And believe it or not, it is everything that we're saying, as foreign as hip hop could be to a little girl in Maracaibo City in the Caribbean, in Venezuela, it is actually so close.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
And it's just a big cultural mesh that the world has become with globalization, and even each war. Each war that we have in the world throughout history will actually create all this opportunity for cultural exchange, because when the soldiers go to a place they have been locked up, you know, all they come with their culture.
Right.
And so after so many years of this, you would think that there would be harmony in the cultures. And yet we are still battling cultures that are different from ours. Why is that? What do you think that it, you know, in America politics, for example, we have so many racial issues, and it's an institution. I think racial issues are within the institutions. And my daughter said something that we were arguing about it a couple of days ago. She said that she believes that people don't sin. They actually, there's no sin for people. The sin comes from the institutions, and though changing institutions will fix everything. Mm-hmm. And I find that very deep and at the same time very naive, mm-hmm. because the institutions are made what we make of them.
By people, right? I mean,
so it's such a close circle,
right.
You know?
So your daughter must have read some Marx at some point.
So do you think there could be, that is achievable, some cultural harmony so that everybody can have the same opportunities and the
right.
same, I mean, is that even achievable in the world nowadays?
Right, wow. That really is a tough, tough question. Right, so I think that, you know, we have to ask who truly wants America to be at its highest potential socially, right? Because I do think that, you know, we have to address then, you know, confronting bias and promoting equality and addressing hypocrisy, for instance, right? And ensuring that, you know, all Americans, in this case, irrespective of race, class, gender, or even sexual orientation, can live without, right, the threat of its government and the threat of its legislators to exact violence upon them, right? Whether that's physical violence, psychic violence, spiritual violence, right? Who can I love? Who can I work? Where can I worship? You know, what can I, you know, how can I walk upon the street? You know, the various just sort of human, you know, realities that certain people within the American context can't take for granted, and others mm-hmm. can. So I think that when we talk about harmony, we have to first talk about being honest with ourselves, realizing that we can't ignore our biases, right? We can't ignore what we think about when we look at people of color, right? I mean, I'm a PhD, I have a good education, and I have friends who are various races, not just, you know, white or anything. I have students who come from even blacks, quite frankly, who would say, well, depending on where they're from, you know, you can, you know, trust them. Or I have an Ethiopian student, she is so sweet, and she told me, she said, you know, the one thing that, again, this is Ethiopia, right? This is Africa, right? So I have an Ethiopian student who said that one thing that her dad said before she came to America was just not to fall in love with an American black guy, right? So you start thinking,
from Ethiopia.
Right? So you start thinking like, well, dang, you know? So it becomes an international reality. There's something about being black in this American context that creates dis-ease and unease among not just folk in America, but folk across the world. And so when you have, for instance, Mayor de Blasio in New York, who has a white wife, I mean a black wife, he's a white man, who has a black wife and has a mixed kid, and then he tells New York as mayor that he has to sit down with his son and have serious conversations about how to deal with the police, right? That's a real conversation that parents of children of color have to have. And then instead of the New York police folks understanding that reality, they then blast de Blasio, turn their back on him, say they're throwing the police under the bus. And I'm like, no, he's being a father, right? There are certain real things, right? I know police officers personally, and this is where the hypocrisy comes in, because I know police officers personally who would tell their children don't go in certain neighborhoods because those N-words, those other people are crazy, right?
Yeah.
So again, don't act like there's something wrong with us, with people telling the truth about the fact that we have these biases. I mean, we'll tell a girl on campus, right, to make sure that if you're walking, you know, across campus at night, to walk in twos or threes, right? Or we'll have that conversation very openly, right? But we won't have a conversation, you know, talking about, you know, the different gazes, if you will, that people have about people of color, right? I mean, we have to have that conversation. And so
yeah.
I think in order for harmony to take place, truth has to take place, and understanding that it's not, you know, and making a difference too between people who are just, you know, just buttholes, if you will, and people who are racist, right? I mean, even though all races are buttholes, not all buttholes are racist, right? And so, you know, some people are just ignorant. Some people are just buttholes. Some people are just, like, mean, you know what I'm saying? And their meanness might or might not have to do with racial antipathy, right? So we can't just sweep everything with a broad brush and say everything is race and racism, but at the same time, we cannot decry that, oh, well, I'm not going to take it seriously because you're, quote-unquote, pulling the race card. And so in this book, for instance, I have these conversations, especially in Chapter 2 and Chapter 3, I have these conversations about how America, who thought with Obama, who thought that now we're going to live this sort of new life, right, this sort of post-racial reality, and something about Obama then was sort of, you know, we won't consider race anymore as a social practice because, mm-hmm. hey, we got a black president and we have a black first lady with black children, you know, that kind of stuff. But what have we seen since then? We, you know, we've seen more hatred upon the White House. We've seen people talking about the black children just recently, right? Fox News had to, quote-unquote, admit that, look, we have to take down our story about Malia going to Harvard because somehow, some way, there are some bad comments on our site about about racist comments on our site, as if they're shocked, right? As if somehow or another this just started today, right? And it's like, wait, what are you talking about, right? So I think that really America, in order to get to where you be, you know, where you're talking about, I'm a harbinger of hope primarily because, you know, I'm a Christian, right? That's the first thing, right? But at the same time, I'm not calling for a utopia, right? I don't think that we'll live, you know. I still think, like St. Augustine said in his book, In City of God, we still sort of live in a city of sin, right? And so your daughter, I mean, I would love to have a conversation with her, but you're right. I mean, people make up institutions, right? And institutions, though, do protect other people. Right. And so these institutions are created. For instance, the police. Right. People say, well, all police officers aren't racist. OK, fine. No problem. We have no problem with that. Right. But the structure, the institution of the police force intentionally is created in order, historically and today, in order to sort of create a sort of an overseeing of primarily inner city, primarily urban people. And that comes into being with our criminal justice system, right? Mm-hmm. It comes into being with you know with the ways in which we see. I mean, the federal government, right? This federal government has then put cities on notice: Chicago, Baltimore, Ferguson, and said, "Look, we're reviewing your tickets. We're reviewing the way in which you exact justice mm-hmm. in your criminal courts, and you are doing it wrong, and you're doing it in a way that exploits Black people." And people say, "Wait a minute, how can you say that?" Well, it's easy to say if a town like Ferguson that has like 25,000 people in an area of St. Louis County, if that area then constitutes 85% of the income of your court systems, something is wrong. Why aren't you policing the other 80% of the county? So you think, and then when the kids of Ferguson uprise and they say, you know, you're mistreating us, you know, we think they're crazy. But they're not crazy. They live this. They live the fact that every day they're being harassed and every day they're being, you know, mistreated and getting ticketed and fined for stuff that makes no sense in order to fund a city when you got 80% of the other part of the county that doesn't even see a police officer, right?
Yeah, it is.
And so
true.
It's like, what's wrong with it? So I think we have to speak the truth to that, Susan. I think so. Part of that, has to do with, I think you said about the idea of hope, and I think I'm a harbinger of hope. Again, I'm not calling for a utopia, but I think I am calling for civility and compassion, especially when it comes to our lawmakers.
I think that there will be so many things, even if it doesn't touch the lawmakers, just by the regular people showing more compassion and more love. If I raise a child and I raise it with love and showing them compassion and teach him that we have all the same heart, and that person becomes a policeman in urban New York, that will be somebody that hopefully will not be corrupted by the system.
Yeah. And that's why your daughter has a point, though, right? Because
that individual still
has to live in that culture of the police force, right?
But then they go to a place where an institution has its ways, and, you know, we all go through it in school.
Right.
You
right.
know,
we
come out of the house one way, and we come back from school a different way.
No question.
You know, so it's sad. But as long as we have hope, I guess, you know, there is a possibility of things changing, hopefully in our lifetime.
I think
you know?
So.
You know?
And the beauty about being a democracy, right, is that, like you said, I mean, the people do have the ability to make these changes, right? You know, and so, and given that America's still young, right, as, you know, we talk about this as if we're Rome or something, right? So, I mean, the reality is that we're young, right? And so, as a young country, we're still learning. We're still trying to understand what it means to be a democracy. And so, as such, this is an experiment, right? We're trying to get this a democracy thing right? After what I like to call, you know, starting behind a moral eight ball, right? I mean, we started with imperialism and slavery, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's hard to kind of get away from that if that was literally the foundation of this country, right? And so, and it's definitely not going to eradicate itself in the short time, you know, not even 400 years yet of our existence, if you will.
You know, I can keep talking until tomorrow about this. I don't know if you've noticed, but
I think we passed 30 minutes. Right?
I really love it. Before we go, I want to tell our listeners again, check out Racial Realities and Post-Racial Dreams. It's an awesome book. It will wake you up. And, you know, you just spell it as it is, and it's very understandable to people like me that, you know, I do have, even though I also write in English and whatever, I do have a handicap in English. And, it's wonderful, understandable for regular people.
Thank you.
And it should be read.
Thank you.
You can check it out at www.juliusbailey.com. And again, that is JuliusBailey.com. Julius, thank you so much for being here. This was such an interesting conversation, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Jesus.
All right, listeners, thank you again for being with us, and until next time. Bye.